But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Wealth Show, where we discuss the key topics shaping the UK wealth management industry and investors' portfolios. I'm Sophie Downes, and I'm joined today by Elsa Littlewood, tax partner at BDO, to discuss new research from the firm which shows that 90% of ultra-high net worth families are experiencing disagreements around their wealth. Welcome to the podcast, Elsa.
Hi, lovely to be here.
Firstly, tell us a bit about this research. Why is it commissioned and who was included?
So we decided to do some research because there's a huge wealth transfer going on at the moment, billions and billions, trillions, in fact, of money. And we wanted to understand as advisors, what were our clients, our future clients, thinking about this, both the wealth creators and the heirs and successors? So we commissioned some research using an outside agency, and it's really the brainchild of my colleague Richard Montague, and he's worked incredibly hard on this. So the outside agency went to 300 heirs, successors, wealth creators and advisors and asked their opinions on basically the transfer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some staggering statistics in here, but from your experience at the coalface, what in it surprised you the most?
Do you know, there was a lot in there that didn't surprise me, but a sort of from experience, anecdotally, we sort of knew there were some of the issues and what people were thinking. But I guess it was that 90% statistic that did seem high. Obviously, we see lots of conflict, but I wouldn't say see that in 90% of my clients. So that was quite a surprise.
And I mean, the survey talked to people with at least £20 million in investable assets. At that level of wealth, I think you could be forgiven for assuming life is just a little bit easier, perhaps. Why is so much friction being generated behind closed doors?
Gosh, that's such a good question. Why is it? I think there's an expectation gap between those that create the wealth and those that are receiving that, inheriting that. It's so different depending on the facts of the family in question. So if you look at multi-generational wealth where the current wealth-owning generation feel that sort of sense of custodianship, it wouldn't be crazy to think there'd be less friction because they're more used to passing on that wealth. They've received the wealth and they're going to pass it on. And maybe there's a very clear line. For example, if we take the fictional family in Downton Abbey, some of the friction there was really around the primogeniture and the way that the wealth had to pass on through the family. Whereas if you look at first generation wealth, where the wealth creator actually created the wealth, they're first generation entrepreneur, they've made lots of sacrifices. Their children have probably seen those sacrifices, and they're not used to going through those conversations and the process of passing on the wealth. So so many different ways that that conflict and friction can be created.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating, really.
And of course, the research highlighted a huge implementation gap. I think it was around 30% of families, it recorded it's only 30% of families that have a fully developed succession plan. So why are so many highly successful people who can afford wealth management and financial advice putting it off?
Do you know, I think a lot of them are busy making that wealth and they're not done yet. And so thinking about what happens next, it gives you a bit of an existential crisis, and it's a difficult conversation. Now, as advisors, we're really used to having those conversations and in a really sensitive way, in a really organised way that's very centred on the client. But as an individual, if you've spent decades, blood, sweat and tears, sacrificing everything to create the wealth, it's a pretty difficult subject to think about, okay, well, what happens when I'm not here? Or am I going to give it to my kids? Is it going to charity? It's a big topic. It's mm-hmm. everything they've ever worked for.
And then on the flip side, I suppose, what are the triggers then that finally push people to the planning table?
So it can be life events, illness, world events. A lot of people start to think about this during COVID. I used to work in the Southwest. That's where I'm from. And there was a really horrible crash on the M5. And it actually triggered several people to contact my firm at the time to say, actually, this happened, we were caught up in it, and it's really made us think about our own mortality. So it can be external events, internal events, a business sale. There are so many different trigger moments.
Mm-hmm. Another aspect of the research which really interested me was this generational divide that it seems to highlight. I think it was 53% of heirs are reportedly clashing over investments. So what exactly are they disagreeing on? Is it risk appetite? Is it thematics? Or is it what actually, you know, should we do with this money?
I think it's all of those things. To launch the reports, we held a debate for our advisor community. I had several of them actually all over the country, with one group of people playing the wealth creators and one group of people playing the heirs and successors. And I was an heir and successor. And what we were trying to demonstrate was, not only is there sort of an expectation gap in terms of investment, but actually there's an understanding gap. And so there's a lot of assumptions made by both groups of people in terms of, well, you know, mum and dad are always going to want to go for traditional investments. They'll want to go for something that's less risky because they've put all the risk into the business or whatever. And the parents thinking, well, the children just want to spend it. And that's just, it's just not the case. So I think there is an investment gap. And I think we certainly hear from our investment colleagues and contacts that the next generation, which of course could be any age really, couldn't it, depending on how old the previous generation is. But, you know, the younger generations are looking at alternatives. They're looking for more impact investing, investing with purpose. There's been so much talk about ESG over recent decade, probably, isn't it, or more. But I think investing with purpose and investing with impact is something that is important to that younger generation. But I think it's actually equally as important to the older generation. I think it's less of an investment gap and more of a communication understanding gap.
Mm-hmm. And actually, to my next point, I think the report said that ultra high net worth individuals ranked ongoing family communication dead last and important for wealth transfer. So is there a sense that the next generation is kind of being kept out of the room when these discussions are taking place?
Yeah, I think that does happen frequently. Of course, big generalization, but that's what statistics give you, isn't it? So we do see that, and that could be triggered by all sorts of different things. It could be secrecy. Some families, the wealth creators, don't want the next generation to know how wealthy the family is because they don't want to dampen their own entrepreneurial spirit. They're fearful of what it might do to them, what it might create in terms of that next generation and their attitude to wealth. But you also see the next generation wanting to be involved and saying, well, you know, talk to us so we understand. We want to learn from you. We want to understand how you made your wealth. We saw the sacrifice. We saw you worked really hard. We've seen the stress, and maybe we've seen the spoils of it too, you know, the benefits of that. But actually, talk to us. Let us learn from you. And a really interesting area to get the next generation involved in, which sort of dampen or diffuses some of that friction and concern, is around philanthropy. So coming together as a family with a charitable purpose in mind, getting the whole family of multiple generations involved. And actually, you can go pretty young if you're thinking about investing for purpose and impact, and allowing the next generation to learn and prove their worth and prove their ability to be act as a custodian of wealth through that philanthropic activity. And it's a great way of bringing the family together, but also talking about the wealth and opening up those lines of communication.
Has there ever been situations, you know, I suppose what happens, what should an advisor do in the situation when the next generation says, actually, I don't want anything to do with this money or the family business? What happens in that scenario?
Yeah, it's tough. It's really tough when you, as an advisor, obviously, we've got to think about our obligations to our client, and our primary client is usually the wealth creator. That's who we've been acting for a number of years. And we've got to advise them on their wishes. But actually, of course, our duty of care extends to helping them do the very best for them and for their family. And all we can really do is, I guess, advise in the non-sort of technical sense, try and encourage conversations, encourage them to talk to the next generation, because there really is no point having a whole succession plan, a business succession plan, a wealth succession plan, all hinged on one particular family member taking over the family business. If that person isn't showing any interest, it's going to fail.
Mm-hmm. And of course, on a prequel prior to this podcast, Alison and I both discussed that we'd been watching a recent Netflix documentary about the Murdoch family, which feels very apt to bring in right now. And I'm sure many of our listeners are big fans of the programme Succession. I mean, obviously, that's a slightly extreme example. But do you see that same dynamic play out in client families? I'm thinking particularly here about almost the complete breakdown of family communication and relationships because of money.
Yeah, I think if you, I love the the Succession series, completely glued to it. And it was a bit like a busman's holiday, but of course, don't have that extreme experience. But I have been party to some really sad family breakdowns. And it's never just about the money. It's never just about the business. It's so, you know, it's proper entrenched family issues. And you imagine, then we all have, you know, disagreements with our family. You then put all of your sort of wealth, you know, everything you work for into the same pot, your jobs in the same pot, you all work together. And it's a real pressure cooker. And yeah, some really irreparable relationship breakdown. And it's really sad for everybody.
I'm curious, from your perspective, watching it as a tax expert, do you find yourself thinking, okay, well, maybe if that had been mitigated or someone had stepped in then, you know, is there an ideal situation that could have played out?
Oh my gosh, they all just need therapists, don't they, really? And I think that's, without, you know, sort of laughing aside, I think that is part of what's needed. You know, as a tax advisor and, you know, my colleagues that are wealth managers, the investment managers, the lawyers, land agents, if we're talking about landed businesses, all of those advisors working together in a really collaborative way can really help. Because if they're getting the same sort of messages from all their advisors, it helps. None of us are qualified therapists. Mm. And I've definitely had days when I've come home and thought, that's what was needed in this situation. And you just try and be a good friend and a good listener and try and coach people through it. But I do look at the Succession family and think, you just need a lot of therapy. But there are moments, and it's not for me or for the lawyers or for the investment managers to say, okay, our advice is you must do this, because we're not relationship counsellors. We're not mediators. Actually, some of the lawyers are mediators, but I'm not. But as a good advisor that's really looking after the whole client and the whole family, we can encourage and we can coach. And try and get them to take those steps. I remember to have a situation, really sad family situation, and spoke to one member of the family and I spoke to another member of family in different generations. And they just wanted to spend time together away from the business. And so that's what I encouraged them to do. And they went off to play golf, you know, once a week. And I came away thinking, I'm not really sure that's what they need a tax advisor for, but to achieve the right end, communication was far better and we're able to move forward.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a really interesting dynamic. I mean, we had Lewis Koch, director of private clients at Charles Stanley, on the podcast, I think a few months ago now. And he was arguing that the role of a wealth manager advisor has changed dramatically. And it's no longer about just the investments or just the data. It's that human realm as well. But of course, as you said, you know, that is a separate job, and it's maybe not the one you thought you were getting into when you were doing your exams.
But you know, it is so satisfying. You know, if you get given the exam question, you know, in a sort of technical sense, this is the transaction, what is the tax outcome? Great, we can do that hour after hour, day after day, year after year. When you meet a client, and what I love about working in private clients, and as your previous guest will feel the same, is getting to know that person, that family. Because on paper, two clients could look exactly the same. Same wealth, same family set up in terms of number of children. They could even have the same sort of same objectives. You know, I want to pass on at this age and I want to buy this house and whatever. But it's actually, you've got to get under the skin and really get to know the client, understand what makes them tick, what they really feel about things, because then you can start really advising. Because to get to an end result, you could do in so many different ways. Do people want to leave all their wealth on death? Do they want to give it during their lifetime? You know, there's so many different options in passing on wealth and involving the next generation. But really getting to understand the client, really understand, get inside their head, I guess. And that's really satisfying when you can advise somebody. I always say to them, look, we're going to get the tax right. You will pay the right amount of tax. You'll be compliant. We're all of that right. I just need to know you. Once I know you, I can then advise you how to do this in the best way that's going to be the most successful for you and your family.
And I suppose that's the distinguishing factor between, you know, a human advisor and then an AI one, or one that we might get through robo-advice or something like that.
It's fascinating, isn't it? It really is fascinating. Going totally off topic, I used Copilot recently to help me solve an issue in my own sort of personal life. Nothing, you know, too dramatic. But it was like talking to a friend, but a friend that really, I guess a coach or kind of like a therapist. It wasn't that sort of dire, but, you know, getting a perspective that's reacting to what you're saying is really interesting. So I think AI definitely has a role to play in what we're doing. We're learning about it more and more every day. It's making us more efficient, more effective. But I think it's a long time, if ever, that AI could totally replace advisors in any of these situations. I think learning that much about the human condition, it would just take a huge amount of computer power.
I think so. I don't think we're there yet. You mentioned there about there being a somewhat of a line, I suppose, for people who are dealing and getting more involved with the quite complex dynamics of a family. Where is that line? When should an advisor say, okay, you know what, this isn't really my role anymore, I don't feel like I can step in now? What do they do?
God, that's a really good question. I think having a team of advisors and making sure that your client recognizes the benefit of the advisors working really well together. One, it's more fun, as you know, we all get a kick out of, you know, this sort of stuff as tax nerds and the rest of it. But, you know, having that group of advisors to discuss things with, lean on in situations like that. I've definitely had to do that in the past. It was actually a capacity issue with a client. And we were all getting calls and having really odd conversations. And we just alerted each other to it. And then we were able to talk to the family more broadly. And we could come up with a way that respected the client and the conversations they wanted to have, but didn't send the advisors off down, you know, sort of rabbit holes on things that the family didn't really want to do. And we were sort of then managing the legal side of capacity. So in summary, answer to your question, I just don't think there is a particular line. I can't say if this happens, then I need to stop and question. But I think talking to my colleagues about difficult situations and talking to those other advisors about sort of concerns, I think is really helpful. And that the collaboration among advisors is absolutely critical to success in any of these situations.
Do you think as this progresses, and I imagine new things emerge, do you think it might be a case where firms will have to step in and think, okay, maybe we can offer some sort of training, or might have to take more proactive steps in that way, so it's not solely on the advisor and their colleagues, do you think?
In terms of the firm themselves, so in BDO, in my situation, providing that training. Yeah, and we do a lot of softer skill training, looking at communication styles of our clients to make sure that the way that we interact with them has the best outcome for them, that we're not, you know, if somebody needs to know all of the detail, all of the section numbers and legislation, that's great, we can give that to them. Some just want three bullet points. Of course, there's an element of having to provide other information as your investment guest will absolutely know in that compliance regulated world. But I think perhaps more and more, and then we've got to make that positive decision with, do we want our people in those situations? Are they equipped? Is it right? Is it a liability from a business perspective we want to take? Or do we just want to have nice human people that interact with our clients? And can we help people do that better and then support them at the back end? Yeah.
I'm interested in your career. Has, you know, I think when we had Lewis on previously, he said this is, you know, it wasn't like this when he began. From your experience, what's been the balance between that human element and purely tax advice?
It's a really good question. I think it has changed. I don't know whether that's because the industry has changed or because I'm more experienced. So I feel more able to have those conversations. I think COVID changed a lot. We had a real insight into our clients' lives. We didn't have the same, we could do video calls prior to COVID, but not the way we all do today with Teams calls, you know, endless Teams calls all day. We saw the families, we saw into, even though I've always worked in private client, and so always dealt with that sort of personal element of people's wealth, we just didn't have the same insight. We didn't talk in the same way. I think we all went through something that was really seismic change. And I think we all became a bit more honest and a bit more vulnerable. And maybe that's why things have changed more in the last 5-6 years.
Mm. And that's a really interesting distinction, especially the push to go more online. From your experience now, what do clients, I'm thinking particularly about the clients who would have been recipients of this survey, do they, what's the balance between in-person meetings and online? Is there a preference?
Well, I think we all know that putting in a 45-minute Teams meeting is really easy from a busy diary perspective. That works for a lot of meetings. I really like to see clients face-to-face, particularly in the initial stages of a relationship, because I say to them, you know, you're asking me to help you pass on your life's work and to not ruin the lives of your children and to respect your wishes and help you create something, create a plan that achieves all of that. But we need some time together because you need to trust me to do that. You have to understand my methodology the way I think, and I really need to know how you think. So let's meet at least once or twice in person. Then we can do loads online, and that's great. But we've got to have that human connection. And it's really different in the room. And I think most people would agree with that. Sometimes you can't, you know, if they're overseas. It's not possible to fly all over the world. And, you know, it's not good for the environment. It's not good for the timesheet. We will, of course, if necessary. But it's having that sometime, particularly if you're discussing perhaps you've given the advice, you've given some options, and now we're choosing that route. Being able to read the room and feel, you know, the what's going on in the room and understand sort of what's going on emotionally is just so important. And it's time well invested for them and certainly time well invested for us as advisors.
Mm-hmm. And talking about the push to online, I mean, I'm interested to hear from your perspective. Obviously, there's this big narrative that with every tax change we see, high net worth individuals fleeing, see the big exodus of the wealthy. How true is that from what you're seeing?
Yeah, people are leaving. People have left. People are still planning to leave. The changes to, you know, the non-dom regime, which is what we had, impacted non-doms, as you would expect. We have to remember those people are always going to leave the UK. They weren't here for life, otherwise they wouldn't be non-domiciles. Like maybe getting a bit technical there. But they're always going to leave. Did they leave a bit earlier? Yes, some did. Did some leave a lot earlier than planned? Absolutely. Have some decided to stay here for the amount of time they were planning to stay here? Absolutely too. It's a real mix. But yeah, I've seen people go. And we're still advising people on, you know, what it means to leave and how they leave effectively. And then using our international network to get them the advice into wherever they're going. So people are definitely leaving, but we're seeing people come too. Mm. And that is beginning to ramp up.
And if people are leaving the country, where are they going?
Yeah, going to lots of different places. So some of our non-dom clients are going home. So it could be literally anywhere in the world. Italy has been popular. Certainly a lot of people investigating what the flat tax regime means in Italy, what it would mean for them. Italians going home, Italians that have been here for a long time and so qualify for the regime back home and they're heading home. Middle East has been popular and people are still planning to go to the Middle East. Singapore, I've got people going to the US, which some people might find slightly odd because it's sort of another relatively high tax jurisdiction, but it's for business reasons. Mm. You know, people aren't moving just for tax. They're moving for lifestyle. They're moving for business opportunity. They're moving to try something new.
I think that's probably something the narrative isn't always landing on, is it? It's a slight misconception there.
Yeah, I think it is a real misconception. Our clients want to pay the right amount of tax. They are happy to pay tax. They have successful businesses, successful work lives, and they know they have a moral obligation to pay tax and they want to. It's a privilege. It's, you know, it's a sign of doing something well, isn't it, if you've got to pay tax. What they don't like, and probably the driving reason and the main driving reason with my clients, has been the lack of certainty and clarity in the system. There's been too many changes and so much uncertainty. This isn't just about the current government. This is going back, you know, to previous governments, concerns about general elections, changes in leader, populist policies, ideological policies. And I think they've just got change fatigue. So they said, I can't plan here. I had a plan. That plan I've been working towards for 20 years, everything's changing and I'm just fearful. I don't know whether I'm going to be paying tax on this gain, or this is going to be income, or this is going to be tax to inheritance. I just don't know anymore. I've had enough. And that's really sad, because that, it is. We feel it as well as tax advisors, as, you know, private client advisors, that change fatigue, it takes its toll.
Well, I mean, you know, the whole tax environment coupled with the complex internal family dynamics does not make successful or easy succession plan, at least.
Yeah.
So as a parting gift to our listeners who might be listening to this and having the same situation with their clients who maybe are coming to sort their succession plans and maybe are struggling with these kind of family dynamics we've discussed, what would be your advice to them?
I think it's really important to be curious and not shy away from the difficult conversations. If you go in with the right intent, then you can ask these questions, find out what's really going on. You know, you'll be able to feel it in the room. You'll be able to see it in the communication or lack of between the different generations. And so just sort of stopping, calling it out in a really human, really empathetic, caring way is really, you have to do it. You can't ignore it. And I think if your listeners are feeling uncomfortable about that, or it's sort of uncharted waters for them, talk to colleagues, talk to more experienced colleagues, talk to the other advisors, and get some coaching and help yourself to have those conversations. I think it's really important. People need to be curious. They need to be empathetic, have the right intent, and be bold.
That's a very nice note to end it on. Thank you for joining us today, Elsa.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We will see you next time.
Today is VE Day. The boys
the newly crowned queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing
landed.
Down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth: cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
And Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.